This is a test.
It's recording.
All right. It's 7 o'clock, so let's call tonight's regular meeting of the North Bend Planning Commission to order. Tonight is Thursday, September 26th. First order of business is take roll call. Can we... Hello to all the... Hello, commissioners way over there. Scott, can we start with you?
Commissioner Greenberg.
Commissioner Torgerson.
Commissioner Colon.
Commissioner Bovers.
Commissioner McFarland.
Commissioner Miller.
And Chair Tao is here, and from staff.
David Miller, CED Director.
Mike McCarty, Senior Planner.
Jesse Reynolds, Planner.
All right, welcome everybody. Before we get started, I'd just like to thank Commissioner Greenberg for chairing in my absence a couple of weeks ago. Thank you very much. Next item is approval of tonight's agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting?
So moved.
Second.
And move to approve tonight's agenda by Commissioner McFarland, seconded by Commissioner Greenberg. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. The agenda is approved. Next item is approval of the minutes for the meeting that I was not at, September 12th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner McFarland, seconded by Commissioner Greenberg. Any discussion? I'm going to abstain. I wasn't here. All in favor, say aye.
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 None opposed. The minutes are approved. And now it's an opportunity for members of the public to share some comments. Is there anybody who would like to share any comments tonight?
Come on.
Oh, going once, going twice. Okay, moving right along then. First item of business on the agenda is a presentation on the Mestia partnership.
Okay, I'll kind of kick it off and then Jesse will continue with it. We're fortunate to be able to have this opportunity because Jesse had worked for an international consulting firm, OTAT, and in that assignment he worked with a really brilliant guy that is a Dutch fellow that runs an international kind of consulting marketing end of the thing and is doing work all over the world, and landed a contract to do some work for Mestia, Georgia. And as we go through the presentation, this is kind of the fun part of the meeting, Jesse will show you where it is and what it's all about, and we have a number of really great photographs that will kind of get you into Mestia, get you into Tbilisi, the capital, and get you into Georgia and get you into the whole thing. And it's really, really quite an experience. Both, I don't know how many of you know Leroy Gant. He's a local architect. You certainly know him well, Jim, because he designed your building. But he is really, really talented. And he and I, when this originally started, it's called a twinning experience. And it's really, I guess it's the first that they've done. The Asian Bank funds it. They're funding development in countries throughout the Middle East and elsewhere. And they're promoting such things as tourism and capital improvements and the things that we like to see happening in countries that need that sort of thing. And they need expertise to do that. So one of the experiments that they participated in is trying to find a mountain community that had similar characteristics so that they could draw from some of the expertise we have, and we could do some technology transfer and planning to them because they have great needs, and that we could learn from them, and we certainly did a lot. And so the assignment for us was to prepare a request for proposals that they'll put out for about a $400,000 piece of work to write for them, I guess, their first zoning ordinance, and to put together design guidelines for their development. They're probably the fastest growing tourist town in the country, and some say in Europe. They're growing very quickly with their tourist industry. They have a lot of construction. They have two ski lifts, and they're going to add four. They have an airport that is one flight in and out a day, which will be increasing flights over time. And they needed some professional expertise from us. So through the OTAC folks and their government at the actual national level there, they were able to obtain this grant to do the work. And the first person over was Jesse, and Jesse had the relationship and helped put together kind of a work program that we needed to follow. And we followed up with a second group, which was myself and Leroy, to look at the needs for zoning and the needs for design guidelines. And Leroy's a very talented designer. He is on contract to us to help us do design review as we have projects come through. And we went over and we were absolutely blown away by the opportunities, the incredible beauty of the area. The Caucasus are the mountains right at Mestia, at your doorstep. There are no taller mountains in the world but the Himalayas. The Caucasus go up to about 18,000 feet and they're just magnificent. They don't allow clear cutting there, so their forests are incredible. And they have a number of hamlets in the area, and they have a history that's incredible. They have an 8,000-year-old wine industry. They have over 5,000 varietals. People come from all over Europe. We met people from Israel and Turkey and all over the Middle East that come there to hike because their out-of-doors is next to none. Incredible. So they have one heck of a tourist industry that's going, and it wasn't always that way. But in the past 18 years, one of their presidents turned it from the most dangerous place to travel to the safest place to travel in Europe. And you'll find out who their neighbors are, and you wonder how it can be safe knowing who they are. But it's a great story. And what we were to do is to go over there and kind of get soaked into the culture and into the particular challenges they have. And they have a very visionary mayor who took us on a tour and talked about how they would like to turn their downtown into a pedestrian environment. Right now it has lots of vehicles because you have tour groups leaving from there, you have people driving their own cars in there. They have 2,000 guest rooms in a town of about, what, 3,000?
2,000.
So imagine that. If we had 7,000 guest rooms here, it would be equal. So they have a tourist industry that's just going like a big machine. They have two great ski lifts. They're going to add four and probably an alpine village. And so when we were toured around and we were given all of these opportunities and we looked at the physical layout, because there's one road in and out, and then you can go beyond that as you go up toward the Caucasus and it ends. And so how do you deal with this? And so when we originally went over there, they said, we want you to look at the zoning ordinance. We want you to look at parking regulations and design guidelines. And after we had the tour from the mayor and saw his vision, we thought that whole scope should change. What they really needed was a mobility plan, because you have to get out of buses and out of your car and get into a shuttle to go to the downtown. And what they wanted was electric vehicles that were four-wheel drive, because they have some incredible snow in the winter. They have cobblestone narrow streets like Europe. And they wanted to be able to transport people to their rooms and to the guest houses and hotels and destinations without having any internal combustion cars and without messing up the pedestrian environment. So Jesse, while we were over there, we gave him a phone call and said, Jesse, you've got to find a golf cart that seats eight people and is electric and four-wheel drive, so get on it. And he looked and searched, and he actually found such a beast in Italy. So we thought this was going to be a planning consulting thing, and it turned out to be a little bit of an automotive search for mobility. And Leroy was great. He sat down, and the mayor sat at one end of town, and when you come into town, they wanted a multi-level parking garage that goes down from a grade down toward the river, and it's very, very steep. So while the mayor was talking, Leroy sat down, started sketching, and drew it up, and put on each level some landscaping so you couldn't tell it was a parking garage, and then constructed it with a bus parking area on top with a roundabout where the buses would drop people off, and you could transfer to get into either your tour bus. They have very small vehicles that will take eight people, four-wheel drive, and they go to these seven little hamlets that are around that people visit. And we also had to accommodate some, you know, restroom facilities, coffee shop type thing. And then you could transfer, if you wanted, into one of these shuttle vehicles that would take you to the city hall where you'd get into the electric vehicle and go to your area. On the other end of town, we had a parking lot they'd already described they wanted for employees and people from the community to park and then come into town so that we're getting... See, the main challenge here, they said parking, and we said, no, it's not parking. This is a mobility plan where you can take vehicles out of the downtown and make it a walkable community. So you had an entire... and, you know, it's really funny how this harkens back to your experience. As I worked for the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority, and I worked on BART around the bay, I worked on heavy rail, light rail, and kiss and ride, and transfers between different modes because you big transfers in transportation. So this kind of, I thought, whoa, this is a transportation plan, and Leroy ran with it, and we think there's another parking area needed near the airport in the Alpine Village that will serve all of the ski areas. So he quickly sketched this plan together, and then flushed it out and developed it more, and we'll show you some graphics at a later date on that. So we had a mobility plan. We decided that it was ridiculous to take our Euclidean zoning and try to put it in a European environment where they use more radio plans, more organic plans, and they aren't orthogonal in blocks. So I had done a lot of work with some people who wrote the Bible on form-based codes, and I dug into it and I said, that's what they need, because it's a three-dimensional physical plan, not just at where your uses and your setbacks and your height. It deals much more with the civic spaces, like parks and plazas, and the open spaces, and if it's pedestrian, that's an important area, right? And the relationship of the buildings to that, and opening up and causing more outdoor activity and having a symbiotic relationship with buildings so that it's not a building shut off, cars and people are, you know, the third tier. People are the first tier in that kind of a plan. So we put together a change in scope, mobility plan, form-based codes incorporating design guidelines. And the third thing that we thought was really missing, because planners always do this, is the financing element. Because you get the best plan in the world and put it on the shelf and never do anything. And if you have these large capital improvements that are required, you've got to be able to fund them. So we talked to them about how we fund things and how you can use some local taxes, you know, from your room tax or other things to help fund these things. They're very much top down. The Asian Bank funded all this. They put about $35,000 out for the initial trips and the scope for the RFP, and then another $400,000 to develop the plan for them. And so we had to kind of convince through OTAC that our approach needed to change a bit, and I think they've accepted that. And we really wanted to have a good financing plan, because when you finish it, you want to start out with a project. I mean, it's kind of like this building. If you didn't have a financing plan, we wouldn't be here. So we changed the scope to include those elements, and I think it's going to be accepted and we'll go forward with it. We will end up with a nice product for them. And the objective of this was for us to offer them technical assistance and in turn learn what has made them so successful. They're an old, old culture that is at least 100 years old in terms of transportation, all that kind of thing, and it was very quickly, when the Russians left, foisted in, they wanted to be like Europe, they wanted to be Western. So they're jumping over years of development to land in a 21st century, world-class ski resort, tourist area. And they don't want to give up their culture, they don't want to give up their rich history. You'll see some architecture that's fantastic. And they want to combine those and do it successfully. So it's a real challenge for us. And we think we've accomplished quite a bit with that. And it's probably one of the best forms of diplomacy that we could engage in. In the state our world is in today, and the divisiveness and the fighting, to go and help a country and actually have professional interchange and appreciate one another the way we did is a great diplomatic move. And they're great people, and you're going to meet them because they're coming here in October. We have a lot of really fun activities planned for them and for us. I've never been treated as well as these folks treated us. It was amazing. They spent 2 days in four-wheel drive vehicles taking us up in the Caucasus in the most beautiful places in the mountains you could ever imagine. And I wouldn't have driven on these roads, but they did it. And the mayor's brother took us on these incredible tours. The food there is fantastic. They fed us 12-course meals. They wouldn't let us pay for anything. So we're going to show them the Northwest when they come here. But that's kind of my introduction. And Jesse's going to take you through a slide presentation. He has a lot more information on their culture. He's been there for quite some time. And he's going to give you first context. Where are they? And I'll tell you, when he shows you the countries that are around them, you're going to go, this place could be a hotbed of warfare. And just as an anecdote, just something I learned going there, they're 92% Christian, and they are Georgian Orthodox, which is really very, very traditional. St. Andrew actually proselytized there, and I went into a church he established in 100 A.D., and saw art from 200 A.D. So this is really a great presentation. Go ahead, Jesse.
Okay. So I'll take a couple steps back to kind of give you guys more of a context of the country and why we're even talking about this tonight and how North Bend fits into it. So for just a quick geography lesson, Georgia's at a real crossroads of many regions and has been for centuries. It was kind of a crux on the Silk Road and kind of straddles itself between Europe and Asia. Culturally, it's very European, but the situation of it is in quite a very dynamic region. They've always had a thread of their existence for many centuries, and it's kind of come up through their culture. It's kind of the three things that has kind of kept Georgia is their religion, their language, which is not like any other language in the world today, and their wine. Radiocarbon dated it, and they invented grape wine. So it's something that they've been perfecting for centuries, and has kind of kept them as a cohesive unit. So the Asian Development Bank is an international development bank that floats loans to countries that are developing and infrastructure investments. And their interest in the country as a whole was the fact that Tbilisi, which is located in the kind of southeast corner, about 40% of the nationwide population, but it has about 60% of the GDP. So it's really like the strong horse of their economy.
It's the capital.
It's the capital, and I'll show a couple pictures in a second. So they're looking. There's been a lot of population attrition within the country, and they're looking to kind of bolster these more rural regions. And Mestia, which is this little group up here, is actually a little success story of the more rural areas, in that its economy has been booming lately because of tourism. And their problem now is not attracting the economy; it's how to handle all the growth. In 2022, there's going to be a new road that accesses there, and it's going to increase a lot of visitors. And so it's how do they accommodate all this growth in an area that's really limited as far as isolation and access and infrastructure? So
Jesse, could you go back to one slide? Because it's kind of hard to tell, but when I looked at this myself, just an observation. You've got Russia on one side, and Russia occupies 20% of Georgia. It used to be a part of the USSR. Some of the people liked that. A lot of the people didn't. And Russia came in and occupied part of the area that was sympathetic. On Azerbaijan is on one side. Turkey's on another. The Black Sea is on one side. And to the south of them is Iran. And we know about what's going on in those areas, and there's a lot of unrest. So I think just understanding that's kind of hard to see from the map. They are in a really kind of difficult place geopolitically. Go ahead. So,
Jesse, before you leave that, can you kind of zero us to where Mestia is on this map?
Is there a way to focus it a little bit more?
Okay, great.
I'm sorry. We're waiting for a better visual system. system.
Okay.
This thing
we're going to get a better one. This
you know, I understand the frustration of the graphics in this room, and it's going to improve shortly, but where my mouse is right where Mestia is.
Okay. So the green is essentially the Caucasus running through there?
Yeah, okay. So the greater Caucasus are the spine of the mountain range is kind of how, as my mouse goes. There's also the lesser Caucasus. So the greater Caucasus are where Mount Elbrus is, a bunch of, you know, over 15,000 foot peaks. So it's been a natural barrier between Russia and Georgia for centuries. And then to the south is the lesser Caucasus, which are about 10 to 12,000 foot peaks. And that's been the border between Turkey and Armenia. And so Georgia kind of straddles this area here. There's another small range that divides it, where it's really arid on this side, where Tbilisi is, and then the west side is a bit more greener. And Mestia is kind of nestled in a valley up, kind of, you've got to go way west, almost to the Black Sea, and then head up into, up this pass. It's about a 9-hour drive from Tbilisi, so it's a full day of travel. So Mayor Ken will be getting on a plane tomorrow. They've got a lot of travel ahead. I went to Georgia before I came. It was probably the last, it's basically the last project I worked on before I came to the city of North Bend. And when I was in Mestia, I knew of this thing called twinning. I hadn't heard of it done between small cities before, but I proposed it as part of, I was doing mapping support as well as coming up with a long list of projects. And before I knew it, it made it to a short list of projects. And then the mayor of Mestia was on board, and then I had to float the idea to city council. And after a couple runs with the CED committee, it went to council vote. And
we originally thought he was a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
And he persisted, and we relented.
Yeah. It just is. Yeah. So, yeah, here we are. So Tbilisi is... It's a little bit over a million people, and it's got the climate of Leavenworth and the feel of Eastern Europe. And so we'll just kind of give you a couple slides of this to kind of get a feeling of what Tbilisi's like. Lots of beautiful scenery around. It's a real mix of architecture, you know, everything from kind of 14th century falling apart buildings that are getting renovated to a lot of modern buildings, really walkable plazas, beautiful art. So that's kind of the first place that you would go to when you go to Georgia. And then from there, it's...
Very cosmopolitan, too. Very cosmopolitan.
So, but we're not going to be in Tbilisi. We're going to Mestia. So you take this east-west kind of main road, and then go through this town called Zugdidi, and then up into the mountains, into Mestia.
Very close when you go there. You're within, 20 miles from the Russian-occupied portion, so.
It's pretty close. I don't know if you guys remember the news from 2008, but there was Russia invaded one area here called Abkhazia, and then one area here called South Ossetia, and they're still occupied there. And when you go up the road, it's pretty close, but there hasn't really been any turmoil lately. There's always a little bit of tension when Russia is your neighbor, but it's been a bit more stable lately. So Mestia is a destination for many reasons. The mountains themselves are a great recreational opportunity. They're very scenic, and as David mentioned, there's lots of history and culture. You can see a couple of these photos here and here. There's these towers. These are they're called Svan Towers. Some of them are 800 to 1,000 years old, and they've protected the Svan people, which are the people of this valley, so a subculture within Georgia. They've protected them from natural disasters and human warfare for 800 to 1,000 years. They're a people that have never been conquered, and so they come with a very strong culture that I really encourage you to interact with them. You know, most of them, it'll have to be through an interpreter, unfortunately, but, I feel like there's, while we might be able to provide to them technical expertise, still they have a lot of cultural value that we could take from that as a growing community ourselves. So here's a couple pictures of the settings around Mestia. It's nice, mountainous. You can see the little airport right there. This is a river, the main river that goes through town. There's some pretty iconic peaks. This one to the left is called Ushba. It's been a mountaineer's destination for a couple of centuries. Here's another scene of David and Leroy with the mayor's brother, David, and this is Tekla. She will be our interpreter, and she will be here in a couple weeks.
I think Leroy was doing a little Captain Morgan there.
So here's a little scene from the nighttime. They like to light up the Swan Towers, which makes a pretty cool scene. So it's a really beautiful layout in there. They're right next to the river, which I haven't heard too much of flooding issues, but
it's a pretty ominous river when you're near it.
Fast flowing river.
It's going very fast, and it's carrying a lot of water.
And so there's a bunch of, it's a really cool character of architecture around there. Some modern, some old towers and stuff based off of old architecture. This is the police station right here, and this is the municipal tower. So the Rose Revolution happened 10 years ago, where this one president came in and he wanted to stomp corruption. So what he did was he fired a lot of police officers and then rebuilt a lot of police stations and made a lot of them glass so you could see in. So it's like actual real transparency of what's going on in the police station. And so this was one of the new towers. Well, this is where I did a lot of work, and then where Dave and Leroy were, and where Mike and Mayor Ken will spend a lot of time. This is their municipal building in their town square. Some more older architecture. Here's a Swan Tower. And so this is a newer construction. This is their new cultural center, and it's actually a huge building, and you can't really capture all of the intricacies in one photo, but they really did a good job of kind of matching the scene, you know, the flavor of the city.
It has an outdoor stage here and an indoor stage. The acoustics are amazing. They've really done a good job with it. They actually have in the building, they have residential rooms for actors or performers who come who can actually stay here. And they've done a great job with this. And we saw a performance there of some of their really fantastic dance and music, historic music that is very typical of the Swan culture. And it was fantastic. This is a new building, and I think this was 50% funded by the town and 50% by the Asian Bank. And so they have some new cultural facilities for folks along with this incredibly old history, and they've made the architecture work together.
So there's still, when you get out of the city, there's still a lot of stone and stucco-like material buildings. Really old world.
And some new resort.
And so there's a lot of new resorts coming in. There's a lot of people that come. It's a big destination for Europeans. A bit of folks from the Middle East, Israel and Turkey. But I'd say I met more Germans than anybody there. Mm-hmm. A couple people from the U.S., but I think it's mostly European clientele. And they are doing what they can for hospitality as well. There's a lot of great places to eat and a lot of good places to hang out within town. So that is Mestia, but Mestia is kind of a cluster of townlets. Just outside of it is, of the actual town center, is a town called Ushguli, which is a UNESCO site, where there's the biggest set of Swan Towers out of anywhere. And so this has seen a lot of traffic lately, and there's a lot of efforts to preserve the towers and the heritage, and I guess transportation will be a crux of this place too.
That last picture had a beautiful church in it that's probably a second or third century church. And the Byzantine paintings and the art and the metalwork in some of the art is just fabulous. And it's, when you think of the centuries that have gone by since that was painted, and if you go into these, you have to wear head covering if you're a woman, and we had to, if we had shorts on, we had to put a, you know, a wrap around our legs and that. So they're very, very traditional that way.
Hey, just a quick time check. We got about 5 minutes allotted for this topic.
Okay.
We're going to need more time?
Not for the slideshow, no.
Okay.
No, the goal of this was to kind of give you guys a perspective of the area. As David mentioned, it's a Georgian Orthodox.
We met this guy, and the church he's in was one that was founded by St. Andrew, which was one of the 12 apostles, and it's a first century church. So it's really interesting to see the art and the history.
Here's a classic piece of clothing for the Spahn men.
They have a tremendous museum there.
Great food. We could go into that later. Also one...
cows everywhere.
Yeah, one cool thing about the town is there's cows that just kind of walk down the street. It's a big part of their culture, like cheese and food. And they're
you get fresh milk there, let me tell you. That last picture is their main plaza, and people come into town. This is all hardware, like saws and that kind of equipment you'd find at Ace or at Home Depot. And there were building materials there. You could buy your washing machine or your refrigerator in the back. So here we had the plaza, and you could have a farmer's market one day, and the next day you have Home Depot. It's really incredible.
It's amazing. So with the 2 minutes we have left, I guess, you know, how does this benefit North Bend? And I think that the big take-home picture is this is, you know, oftentimes when we can look at ourselves as a city, we compare ourselves to Snoqualmie or Issaquah. You know, what are they doing? What can we do? Who's, you know, how can we, you know, fit within this region? But really this allows us to kind of take a look at ourselves from a more international perspective, see the way that cultures completely different than us can do things. And one thing that David and I pulled out of this is maybe looking at our zoning code. You know, a lot of our zoning code and zoning codes in the United States are based off a Supreme Court case that happened in the 1920s. And it's about segregated uses. And that made a lot of sense at the time during industrial days. But now that our economy and our lifestyles are a little bit different, you know, maybe we can look at a way to open things up. So form-based code is it's been a concept for a few decades now, but it looks more at the form and function of the buildings and streetscapes and site planning from the outside versus telling you what you can and cannot do inside the place. And so that's the type of code that we're recommending to Mestia, which covers zoning, land use, as well as transportation, all kind of in one package. And I think we want to take that and those concepts and look at places like East North Bend Way. You know, how can we come up with a design theme that has some kind of congruency and uses from one point to another? And so, you know, that's maybe we could have come up with that on our own, but this is really...
It's really impressed us, and, you know, we all want to see what it looks like when it's done. And sometimes the regulations don't end up with that. And if you're more three-dimensional and more form-based and looking at the actual physical product, and you design your codes to do that, you're going to come much closer to that target. The other two things that I bring home from this that I learned is their mayor was so visionary. We tend to enclose ourselves culturally with a narrower view of what we can accomplish and what we can do. And when I see a place like this that steps way out of the box and looks at doing some pretty incredible things to make a place that's very special, I think we need to be a little bit more creative in how we look at what we want to be in the future. The other thing that it taught me is that there's some very creative ways to deal with transportation that we're afraid to look at here. And I think we need to make a couple of leaps of faith, and we need to do a little bit of visioning and create something that we are different. We are distinguished from the rest of this area. We have some great attributes. And what they've done to promote tourism and bring people in and to be a kind of a stepping off place to get into the wilderness and to get into the outdoors, they've done it really well. And I think we can learn some things from them there, too.
Commissioners, questions, comments?
It's Jason.
I love it.
Thank you.
Awesome.
This is a chance for us to learn from them based on our experience there. The second part of this that I'm looking forward to is when they come here and they can observe North Bend. So I think they'll have some insights as somebody new to the United States, new to North Bend with fresh eyes that can say, wow, that's really weird. Why do you do that way? And maybe give us some new insight.
It's a great presentation. I mean, I think this is really amazing, a great opportunity. You talked a couple times about out of the box. I think just getting this partnership formed and having this initiative is step one and out of the box. So it's going to be really fun and exciting to see how it
goes forward. Life can be a lot more exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Next topic is affordable housing. David, are you leading us off on affordable housing?
I am. I don't know if y'all got a chance. I tried to make everything light for this meeting so that we could kind of enjoy this part of it. And what I tried to do is to do a quick overview, not of too much, but of what people are actually doing today. And so when you look through the memo that I put together, I kind of summarize some of the things we've done to try to reach affordability in housing with our accessory dwelling units, making sure that we have an adequate supply of zoning, particularly for multifamily, to protect mobile home parks, and to add mixed uses so that we can get some more apartments in our community. And there are some other things that we're doing. I put our housing element in here just so that people could kind of familiarize ourselves with what we were thinking about years ago. When we get back into that in another year, I think we're going to get much more into brass tacks about actual methodologies to produce the housing. In addition to that, there are a couple of things that we wanted a little bit of direction on. I did put in here, both the mayor and I have been involved in the Affordable Housing Committee recommendations. They have some on a new bill I'm going to talk about to you, but there are just general recommendations, these prioritized items, although I scribbled all over it. They asked us to cut this down into a fewer number of priorities, which I did, and we got back to them. But this gives you an idea about what the entirety of King County is looking at to attack affordable housing throughout the urban and non-urban areas. So in your packet, you have something that says prioritized items. A year and a half worth of work led to an implementation program. They tried to narrow that down into a number of things they were recommending. A lot of them don't deal with us being near mass transit and transit-oriented development and all that, but there are others that do affect us. And so these are the things they're recommending, and we're trying to narrow it down into some things that we're going to put money into. And that gives you a little bit of an overview of what are we doing about affordable housing as a county and as urban areas within this county. And in addition to that, I tried to highlight for you a few pieces of legislation that have been passed this year. One of them is 1406, Senate Bill, and it allows you as a city, if you take the initiative, to pass a resolution of an intent to capture part of the state sales tax that the legislature makes available to cities and counties. There are a number of aspects to the law. If the county participates, they're immediately going to get a percentage of what's available, and you can get about half of that for your community. And so we are going to our council to have that resolution passed. We are going to capture about $22,000 a year over 20 years, which will be about $444,000. This is taking from the state's amount, which is not a new tax.
So it's not a diversion from what we collect.
No, it's from the state share. And what so municipal...
Effectively for the city, an ad.
An ad.
Thank you.
And it's not a significant amount of money. And the number one priority that the council has now, and we intervened in this process, that our senior center has a senior housing project near it that was going to go out of affordability and become market rate. And the senior center didn't want that, and our council didn't want that. And the senior center came to us and said, can you help us? So we went to Dow Constantine's office and got them to help us to stop the sale and to enter into an escrow. And we're given a certain period of time. We're not buying it, but the senior center is, to save it as affordable. And so they're looking at various sources, and I'm fairly sure our council will want to dedicate this money toward that project. And the reason being, it exists. It's not a new project with all of the construction costs and fees that are due. It's a very efficient way economically to preserve existing affordable housing for existing seniors who live there. And I think the council is inclined to go in that direction. So I think they'll want to help them with the financing. But this is the first step in what I hope is many for the state to start looking at this problem, which is a money problem, and starting to put some money into it. So I wanted to tell you about that, and that you'll be seeing some actions that the council will be taking to capture that money and make sure that we get it. So that's one piece of legislation that is a two-day project, getting affordable housing and projects done in our city now. The next one is a House Bill 1923, and I gave you something from one of our greatest. You have something that kind of looks like this, and it's an attachment I put on your in front of you. And MSRC is a resource that local governments have in the state. And it provides great interpretation of regulations as well as many other services. And they published this one, and in your leisure you can read it. But we wanted to come to you for advice. There is a new bill that will fund changing your codes. And they give you 9 different regulatory changes on the second page of this that you can pick from those 9 and 3 SEPA changes, which are really trying to make the environmental process streamlined. And if you pick 2 out of this whole list of 12 options, you then, if you're willing to do the 2, you can qualify to apply for a grant. And it's somewhere in the $20,000 range. We think there are a couple of them that are worth looking at. One of them we did in the town I came from, and it's taking a single-family subdivision and allowing a larger corner lot to have basically a condominium duplex on it. So you'd end up with 2 units with a common wall, 2 entries, one from each street for your parking, your garage, and it would be a below-market rate compared to the other units in the development. You can design them so that it's almost indistinguishable. They're designed with the same quality of interior appliances and features, same quality of architecture on the outside, held to the same standards, but it gives you a little lower price point for units. We think that's fairly benign. In the past, the council hasn't wanted to do it, but they're much more keen on affordable housing than they have been. So we're looking for your advice on that. That's number 3. Number 7, I'm sorry. In single-family zone. The second one would be to perhaps establish a form-based code, and we think that that could be something we could do in our downtown. The problem in our downtown is we have the old bungalows, and we have apartments, and we have the new kind of huge homes that are actually commercial uses. So we have this potpourri of uses, and when you run into problems with trying to get people to accept new projects, it's because of the transition from one housing type to another. Form-based codes require that your transition be gradual and that you fit in and that your three-dimensional plan works with everything around it. And I think that we could have an opportunity for infill that is compatible and is accepted by the other folks in their neighborhoods if we look at a form-based code, because our current codes really hard to match housing types. So we think those two would work, and we think there are probably some other things. We may be able to do something in some of the SEPA-related changes, but what we wanted to do is come to the commission, maybe have you look at this. We don't need a decision tonight, but we'd like to move on it pretty soon. Maybe before your next meeting, take a look at these and read the article that's associated with it that tells you about how the bill works and what's going on here. And maybe make some recommendations to us at the next commission meeting as to those aspects that we could make a commitment to, and then go after some of this money and see if we can start doing things that are real here for affordable housing. Right now, in order to produce affordable housing, and there are two areas where we have the greatest need, and this, there's one other option in this I'd like you to look at, and that would be to look at a density shift and put a new code in that we've talked to you about before for a medium density that might allow for lots, and I've done this in another city, that would go down to as small as 3,500 square feet and look at the old style bungalows that went from 800 to 1,000 feet and maybe create a zoning district where we could do those kinds of things and keep the quality of architecture. But since housing is a per square foot issue, if the lot footage and the building footage is reduced and it's all compatible, you might be able to get the missing middle. And what the missing middle is we used to have an opportunity to go up the rungs of housing. You start with apartments, maybe go to a nice one, maybe a condo, first-time home, a little bigger home, get into maybe a larger home. Right now, we have a sector of the market that is not being met. And people get out of college, their student loans are too great, they can't get a down payment, and a lot of younger people have given up the great American dream. And they're saying, I'd rather live in a nice apartment, I'll never own a home, so I'm giving it up. And what that does, if you take those rungs of the ladder out, you can't go from an apartment up, not only do you affect those who are trying to get up the ladder, but those that are already up and want to sell a home and move up further, there's nobody to sell to because the missing middle is missing. So what we're trying to do is to say, and there's lots of articles nationwide about this problem. And if you look at the kinds of housing that's being built today, 95% of the housing in the Seattle area is apartments. If you look at what we have in our queue, because we can't allow more residential till we get a new sewer plant, out of 680 units, we have approximately over 400 that are apartments. This phenomenon is happening nationwide. Since people can't move into affordable housing, apartment development has taken off like mad. And if you look at it from an investor standpoint, if you don't get your money back till you sell the home, you put all your money into a subdivision, the market changes on you, it's a disaster. And REITs and people that are investing money in housing, it's much safer to invest in an ongoing revenue stream for a product that is a guaranteed product because people need apartments. So it's more attractive to the investors. It's where the market's going for younger people. And we really have a big void there. So how do we fill that void? So one of the options we're coming to you with is, could we do something that's even a lesser product in terms of size of unit, size of lot than cottages? Can we go to a bungalow product?
So I know you're trying to give a high overview overall, but can you just give a little voice to the difference between that concept of the 3,500 square foot lot, 1,000 square foot home, and what we have in cottage?
What we have in cottage now is you're looking at lot sizes that are probably around the 5,000 square foot or close to it, and you're looking at homes that, what do we do, 1,200 to, oh, I think it was 1,500.
Well, I was thinking, yeah, the current code, right?
Yeah.
Which in that, is it limited at 12 or does it go up to 15?
No, it goes up to 15.
Okay.
And so right now we're, you know, if you look at product types, and to me it's really simple because it's dollars per square feet, right? So if you're starting out with a normal home and you're on an 8,000 or 7,000 square foot lot or bigger, and you have homes that are generally over 2,000 square feet, many over 3, got a lot of square footage on the lot, got a lot of square footage in the house. Expensive, right? You're talking 800,000 plus. You drop down to our cottages, and we're about the 650 range, because the ones we built are a little larger than what we changed our code to. And so the missing middle is actually below all of that. And we recently, administratively, approved a 25-unit condo project, which is probably somewhere in the upper fours, and maybe by the time they get on the market, we'll be back up to the fives. So if we're going to try to hit those guys that want to be first-time homebuyers and want to get into the threes, we've got to have a product which, square footage-wise, for the actual unit and the lot, is smaller. And you all taught me that when we looked back at when we grew up and thought about those bungalows we grew up in, there were 800 square feet or 1,000, of which we have some in our downtown now. So it's a viable product. And if we look at it and we design the subdivision well and we design the units attractively, it provides a new housing opportunity for the missing middle. So that's where we're going. And we haven't seen the market go for that yet, but we've had a lot of people talking about it. And in the more urban areas where they're doing infill, they're much more accepting of that. Because when you get in suburban areas where people are moving out of the city to get land and to have more land, and to live that lifestyle, there isn't a lot of focus on the missing middle. But I've become convinced through all of the education that I've gone through that it's a really important group to bring younger people into the community. We're working very hard on bringing jobs into the community, and we'll be presenting a couple of initiatives to you that we're working on right now for deferring frontage improvements and putting them in an LID and deferring them for 5 or 10 years so you don't do little pieces, you do a long piece at once. It allows us some time to think about how we want the street to look. And if you can finance it through an LID and it's cheaper, you can do more quality things on the street. You can do more of it at once. You can let businesses get open and make money before they have that huge outlay of money. You can finance it like you do a house over time and not have to plop all that money into your frontage at once. And we think that's going to be successful. And we have a lot of people looking at locating here. We have our first spec office building coming in. And we have people like Tractor Supply and others that really want to be here, but these frontage improvements are killing them. We had Bates Marine coming. Frontage improvements killed them. You can't have high impact fees and high frontage improvements and make it work here. So we found a way to make it work. And if we think we bring those businesses here, we certainly have to bring affordable housing here, because that's one of the things they're really talking about. And we know from our meetings with the business community, that's a high priority. We hear it from the school district. We hear it from the firemen. We've got trouble here recruiting, right here in this city, bring people in. So those are things that we're looking at. And affordable housing is going to be more and more on the radar. So the commission is really, we're hoping to partner with you and get some great ideas and do some things that actually fill that void. So I just want to give you an overview, leave you with some materials you can read so that you kind of get the mental juices going. And we'd like some direction on this House Bill 1923 to pick from the list. Tell us what you guys think is good for this community and what we should go after, and we'll go after this money and get it. So I didn't want to go long tonight.
Yeah.
I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview. I've given you materials to read. One of the things that I went to a recent conference in Chelan of the Washington Planning Directors, had a great presentation on how to put together an affordable housing plan that includes good inclusiveness from the community and covers all your bases. And we probably, when we do our housing element, we're going to be doing some of this. So I thought this would be good reading for you. So just wanted to give you a quick overview, look for a little direction at a future meeting. And, you know, we keep talking to you about the issue, and I want to stop talking about it and get some action and get some code changes and get some money and start doing some things here.
Rob. Two questions. One, I think, is a simple one. I believe what you're saying is that we will be looking at housing comp plan element 2020.
Yeah.
Thank you. Second one is related to the dollar figure. Can you comment on sort of the value or I'm not even quite sure the right phrase, but in talking about housing choice in relationship to their price point versus keeping the conversation focused around housing choice in regard to size and type and such. Let me be more blunt. If I come to you and I say, hey, you show me a $350,000 product that you can guarantee me that's the price point, I'll approve it.
I think the way that you get to that, we may want to put together something that's a little different than the zoning we've put together here before. There's a tool that a lot of communities have used. I'm sure you've seen it, Scott. It's called conditional zoning. And if you have a particular type of zoning that might be problematic or that you want something specific out of, like affordable housing, you could actually adopt a zoning code that says, if you want to build in this zone, here are the things we want you to commit to. And we have to know that from a pro forma and from a marketing standpoint, it offers a reasonable return. But I think you can put some of those provisions in the code. If you want to build in this zone, we want to meet this need, and there are some conditions that you need to buy into to do it. And what we could offer in exchange for that is some incentives, whether it's a break on their impact fees. There could be some other things we could do, priority processing. We could get some forgiveness on SEPA to not to have to deal with it. There's some provisions in law now for that. So if we really want to reach affordability and we don't have a lot of money to put into it, then we have to find other tools that are attractive. So that's the way I think we have to look at this. So we could use conditional zoning and say that your price point, if it goes above a certain price, it's not meeting the goals in our housing element, and it's not meeting the intent of the zoning district. Because you can follow the market, and if your price per square foot is fair and your return is fair, we want that to be a part of the program. But we don't want the lack of supply to drive the price completely out of the middle, the missing middle.
Scott.
Quick question. So this has to do with new legislation, and I just don't know how active the city has been in trying to propose new legislation or getting involved in it. The reason I'm asking the question, I haven't had a chance to read your handout on House Bill 1923, but the first two things under regulatory changes wouldn't even apply to North Bend.
Right.
And what I found in my experience is a lot of the legislation on affordable housing is designed for the larger communities, the more suburban communities that have light rail or mass transit,
right.
And there's very little for more rural communities.
You're right. One of the things we did with the Housing Task Force is we realized that they would use these transit-oriented development regulations to try to suck up all the money and put it in the urban area. So the mayor and I argued vociferously to say there should be a counterpoint argument for communities that don't have transit. So we did have inserted in the legislation that business of having TOD and light rail would not disproportionately take money away from the smaller communities, and that the smaller communities would have equal incentive in areas they could meet to compete for that money. And we got the language approved. The other thing that we've been doing lately is through a lot of the Washington Planning Directors Association, I'm trying to get involved in their lobbying for legislation on affordable housing. I did the same thing. I worked for the city of LeGrand in the early 90s in Oregon. And the big problem we had is that the Land Conservation and Development Department was promulgating rules. Their legislature only met 6 months every 2 years. So it gave a lot of power to the governor and the department heads. And the Land Conservation and Development Department would promulgate rules. That's legislation. Tell you what you're going to do. And they would put these planning rules out, and they were all based upon the Portland experience. And here we were in eastern Oregon in a town of 13,000. And I called up the head of LCDC, the director, said, we need to meet. You are disrespecting most of the state, and you are forcing, we had one of the issues was garages can be no more than X percentage of the size of the home, because they didn't like the garage and the hall big things that were being built. Well, in La Grande, a lot of people were, they either had man caves with toys, or they had their 18-wheeler in there, or they had other things that were endemic of the lifestyle, and people moved out there for more room and to be able to build these things. And they were near and dear to their hearts. It was like trying to take their guns away in a hunting environment. So I managed to meet with the deputy director and spent an entire day with him. And I said, first I want to tell you what's wrong with your promulgated rules with respect to rural Oregon. Secondly, I want to tell you about a dynamic planning program that we have that's doing every bit as great things as they're doing in the urban areas on our scale. And when I spent that day, they started changing some of the rules for some of the rural areas. This is an ongoing battle in every state. And I think we need to continue to be heard. And there are a lot of planning directors. I met with tons of them at the Chelan meeting that were from Euphrata and Othello and smaller communities that don't have anything to do with, you know, King County and what's happening here. And I think we need to be heard there. And even working with King County, we were pounding on the table about we need a piece of the pie and we have a problem here. And it's true with infrastructure. It's true with housing money. And you just get beat up, you know, if you don't. You've got to be more vocal if you work for a small community than if you work for a large one. And I'm totally on board with that.
Any other questions, comments?
So I have some feedback just on the approach going forward, because I think you mentioned commission going through the materials, and it's all great material, and then coming back with some suggestions or recommendations. I guess I would propose that we actually flip that. I think that the recommendations, the analysis and the recommendations where the opportunities are, right, the benefits, the risks associated, really should come from staff, and that the commission would then react to the recommendations that you make, because I think it could be counterproductive if the seven of us are coming in with proposals or suggestions that may not be legal, they may not be practical, they may not be viable from a variety of standpoints that you would know, but I might not.
Right.
So I think if this list could be kind of summarized in the form
right.
of where you think the opportunities are, that could give us the biggest bang for our bucks.
I hear you. We'll do that.
We'll make some recommendations. I think from a legal standpoint, these wouldn't be on the list if you couldn't do them in the state of Washington.
Well, I'm just saying we have ordinances, we have codes that, you know, may right. constrain our ability to do some of these things. That's what I'm referring right. to when I say legal, the laws that we have in place. So. Okay.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I don't disagree at all with what you're saying. To me, this is kind of like the start of a visioning process. It's pretty high level, and so I think I agree in some of that guidance, but I also think there could be a lot of value on eliciting out of not only the commissioners, but to me, this is huge. This has huge potential, because we're really asking a very broad question of what we may want North Bend to look like in the next 30 to 50 years. And I'm very intrigued by the form-based code. I'm very intrigued by the variety of types of things that you're talking about. And I see that as a very iterative process, along with a lot of community input sessions, not a public hearing, but multiple discussions with them as it develops. And so I'm not suggesting a different path, just along with that. So
yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think there's, you know, the list, I think, is more tactical than the strategic kind of discussion that you were just mentioning, and I think these two go hand in hand. So
I think our real desire was You're the representatives of the community. We can give you the technical input, and I'm really happy to do that. Here are the pros and cons of doing each one. But what we're really trying to do here is, if we're going to do something that's different than what we have today, because we've heard a lot of resistance from the community on a lot of the residential development that's occurred, and what we're looking for is the community values as expressed in the preferences.
Right.
If there are things that you folks, from your experience in the community, think are good for North Bend.
But I think that's a different conversation than reading the materials, looking at the list, and providing some feedback and some recommendations. And I think that's a longer term, more highly structured, facilitated conversation, and particularly if we're soliciting community feedback, either concurrent to what City Council may be doing or in advance of how City Council may be having these conversations, or maybe their joint conversations. So maybe the next step is really to think about how do we want to move the affordable housing conversation forward, what that timeline looks like, and put that process in place.
Sure.
Before we start jumping.
This is kind of introductory.
Yeah, and I think this was all good.
And, the reason that you have these in front of you is, I don't know why the state does this, but they pass legislation and they give you a few minutes to make up your mind. And if you don't turn an application in, you're out of the game. And that's exactly what's happened with this.
That's the tactical portion. That,
and so we're happy to try to accelerate the evaluation process and bring you what we think the positives and negatives are of each one. And we can do that for your next meeting and say we'd like some direction, but I don't want to miss the due date to be able to apply.
Yeah, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I mean, I think we can do that and get in under the window, but I think there's also a longer-term, more visionary, strategic policy conversation that we should probably map that out and kind of break that into meeting chunks. Yeah, exactly. Susan?
On page one, it says something is expected to be due by September 30th, 2019. Have we done whatever that is, or?
I think they've moved that because you know, they got this information. This was just passed this year. This was just passed this year.
It's October 15th now.
Yeah, and it was moved into October. What I might do, if we can't get under the wire by then, is make a commitment to a few of them and a couple as alternatives. And the ones that are the most benign, I think we do need to get into form-based codes. I think it's something that you guys will be very interested in. So we could probably pick that one. And maybe one other, I think streamlining the CEPA process we all want, maybe we can find something in there that would be advantageous for us, particularly in our downtown for infill, you know, having to being exempt for infill, to pick some things that are not very dangerous for us to get into and get our application and say, there's some alternatives we're evaluating, but you're not giving us enough time.
What is the due date?
October 15th.
Yeah. I mean, this is crazy.
For the application.
They just passed it this year. We get this stuff out to us, disseminated, and a month later, they say you've got to get your applications in. So it's a little bit clumsy.
So what's the, in terms of the protocols or the relationship between direction from Planning Commission versus direction from Council? Because our next meeting would be the second Thursday. What's that going to be, the 10th? Which is 5 days before.
Here's what we generally do. Usually with the Council, they want us to come to them if we're going to apply for a grant and ask for permission, or at least if we have to get it in and we don't have time for that, once we turn it in, we report to them and say, if they offer it to us, you've got to accept the terms and we'll bring it to you.
Okay.
So that's generally what we do. One of the other things I'd kind of like to see happening here is that, you know, I come from a state where planning commissions acted on all applications. It made them very political, but it got them into what was happening in the community. And you do a lot of work on planning issues, but I'd like to get the commission a little bit more involved in the nitty-gritty. And part of that is helping us with solving the affordable housing problem. At the council level, they're dealing majorly with infrastructure now. They're dealing with a lot of issues that are big money issues and are not necessary in the planning arena. And I think we've got some great talent here, and you can offer them a lot of help. And I think it will bring you closer to the council by getting involved in these recommendations and being more proactive.
Yeah. So should we plan on the 8th for reviewing your recommendations?
Yes.
Or at least what you're going to put forward?
Yes.
And then maybe before the 8th, maybe we can put together a meeting strategy that takes affordable housing and kind of starts to create some structured conversation and make some progress.
Excellent.
Okay. I mean the 10th, right?
The 10th meeting.
Okay. And we'll go over the strategy, maybe present something at the meeting, and at the same time, here's what our tentative recommendation is. Does it look like it'll fly with you guys? And then we'll get some paperwork in and get in the race.
Right. And then hopefully we can establish a plan for moving the whole topic forward and how we want to use our meeting time going forward. Yeah. Okay, good. Anybody else? Questions, comments? David, anything else?
No, we tried to make this... put a lot into a short period of time and not look for a lot of hard decisions, but give you enough to chew on that we could make some progress.
Yeah, good information. Thank you. All right. Well, I think that wraps up the formal agenda. Any commissioners have anything else for the good of the order before we adjourn? Rob?
Just a couple items about things coming up. Another nice weekend for North Bend, depending on the weather. Volition Brewing's grand opening is Saturday, and also on Saturday, Fall for the Arts at the North Bend Theater, two nice community events. Next Saturday, the 5th, is the Love Snow Quamy Valley event, which is a pretty cool-looking thing throughout the valley, not just North Bend. So if you haven't heard of those.
I'll add one thing since you're talking about fun events. That involve food and other beverages. Snoqualmie Valley Rotary is starting an evening meeting instead of the really special 7 a.m. Thursday morning meetings at the golf club in Snoqualmie. The new evening meetings are, I believe, they're the first and third Tuesdays of the month. I know the first one's October 1st at Iron Duck.
Oh.
I believe it's at 5:30. So it's no host, so you go in there and order and pay for whatever you want, but we'll have one of the rooms reserved for that. And that's also in conjunction with trying to get materials for the Snoqualmie Valley School District food pantry.
So. It'd be great if any commissioners are interested or are participating. We can't, our Tuesday nights are, the council's got us.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. And so it was unfortunate. I really wanted to join. I've been a part of Rotary elsewhere.
Picked poorly.
But they do great things for the community, and we certainly do support them.
Well, there's still 7 a.m. on Thursday morning.
or you should suggest that they should have picked the 2nd and 4th instead of the 1st and 3rd.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea because of the conflict with the North Bend City Council.
As well as Snoqualmie.
Oh, good point.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order?
Right there, okay.
If not, is there a motion to adjourn?
I move that we adjourn.
Commissioner Torgerson has moved that we adjourn tonight's meeting. Is there a second?
Second.
And seconded by Commissioner Miller. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. We're adjourned. Good information. Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.